It's a look in time while you're chatting on Skype. Blow up, close your windpipe. Throw a massive car wreck. Get stabbed in the neck. Blow a life jacket here. Deep for Hurricane Sandy. Carbon monoxide. The state sponsored genocide. At war with the nation. A botched home invasion. Irano, erotic, extinct. Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled... What did I say was going to be entitled again?
You said page 14.
Page 14.
Bottom.
Reincarnation, back on the agenda. See, it's already gone to hell. It's ruined, but we're not going to... No overdubs. Reincarnation, back on the agenda. And it is about being and doing many different things. And in fact, the title is stolen from the poem Waterworld from the book Future Blues by my guest, Mike or Michael...
I guess officially for book publishing, Michael.
Michael Begnal, your book, Future Blues. And so you are someone who knows something about doing lots of different things with one's life.
That's true. I've had many sub-lives within this life, I guess you could say.
Yeah, so you were a drummer in a hardcore band.
True.
True.
Yeah.
You were then...
Going way back,
yes. You were a...
I was in other bands after that.
That's right, Heart of Darkness, which was...
Yeah.
Not hardcore, but good.
Right, okay, so, yeah, my first real band was Waste of Talent. That was during the hardcore era. After that, I was briefly in a couple of bands, one called Positive Hate, one called The Big Thing. After that, I was in a band in Philadelphia called Oblivion, kind of still during the hardcore period, 84 through 1986. And then after that is when I was in Heart of Darkness from, I guess, late 86, maybe like December 86 to late 1991.
Okay, and then you did from there, right? The next logical thing, which was move to Ireland, right? That's the conduit, I think, pretty much.
Yeah. Right? You know,
that's what most
American underground rock and roll to a completely different culture. Yeah, that's the way it goes, right?
Yeah.
What happened was Heart of Darkness moved from State College, Pennsylvania, to Hollywood, we're in search of that record contract, which is what you did at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, you know, getting the record contract doesn't really mean anything in terms of being a successful band. But back then, that was still the model. We actually did that. We moved out to Hollywood. So I was in L.A. for about a year and a half, and then I moved to San Francisco for about 2.5 years, and then I moved to Ireland.
Oh, okay.
So there was
a transitional period you're working up to it
between LA and being in bands and then Ireland after San Francisco. But yeah, I was pretty much out of bands after Heart of Darkness broke up back in like 91. I played with some people in 92, but nothing really coalesced. And
yeah. And so in Ireland, then you were a journalist, right? Am I correct?
I had a number of odd jobs in Ireland, but what I was really doing was writing, and I also edited a literary journal called The Burning Bush. So I was really doing a lot of literary work there, a lot of poetry work.
Okay, and some of that work is in Irish, is in Gaelic, right? Is that
some is.
Yes. So
I learned to speak Irish when I lived in Ireland. I lived in Ireland for 9 years.
Oh wow.
So that gave me ample opportunity to learn the language. Unfortunately, many Irish people themselves don't really speak it fluently, but it does still exist as a relatively strong minority language. And I was able to learn the language and write in it a bit.
Yeah, so
some of those poems are published in my couple more recent collections.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so you speak Crazy Moon Man language, right? Mm-hmm. So it's Crazy Moon Man. And now you're a college professor. And so, yes.
Yeah, right. Well, yes. So to further sketch that outline of what did we call it? What about
Your reincarnation? Your multiple lives?
Right. And multiple lives, yeah. So after Ireland, I was back in Pennsylvania for a little bit, but I wanted to go back to school. I wanted to go to graduate school, and I then got an MFA at North Carolina State University, and somehow miraculously with an MFA I've been able to actually teach on the university level. I started off as an adjunct, and I was actually able to get a full-time instructor position. This is over the course of many years. But that's one of the things that I still do now.
Yeah, and so I think it's interesting that in terms of, like, thinking about all these different contexts and these sort of different, even sort of creative forms, because, I mean, I think there's definitely is an art or creativity to university teaching. I mean, that the reason why I don't go completely insane doing it, I think, or why out of all the jobs that I've had, it's both the most stressful in some ways and the least stressful. And I guess full disclosure, right? You're my future former office mate, I guess.
Yeah, I'm moving on. You're going to have a new office mate, and I'm sure that will be okay, though.
No, it's just going to be awful. You should have thought about my needs when you made these life decisions.
Well,
I
did think about it, and I felt very bad, but I nonetheless, you know...
You didn't. I had to give... No, you better not have.
I did think of it, but I still had to give priority to my own life.
As you do. As you do. And now, as you've gone through all these different, you know, sort of fascinating things, you had the expat experience. I mean, I believe I heard somewhere somebody said at the State Department said that 7 years is sort of the transition point for when people live overseas, that they have to almost sort of become, or that's sort of their gold standard for then when people have to become all sort of reacclimated to American culture or U.S. culture.
Right. It's an interesting thing being an expat, at least an expat from the American point of view, being somewhere else in a different country. As much as I've always loved Ireland and you know, as we said, I lived there for a long time. Of course, you're always, as an outsider, you're always going to remain an outsider to an extent over there. So it's kind of this state where you're constantly betwixt and between, you know, you're never fully Irish. Yeah. Technically I've always been American, but, I lived in Ireland for such a long time that I suppose I was out of touch with many aspects of American culture at one point. But in this age of TV and internet, it's easier to stay in touch. But yeah, no, I did at certain points feel distant from American culture, and so I would be fascinated with things like reality television and stuff like that when I got the chance to watch it.
Yeah, which is, I mean, so there's a couple ways of thinking about this. I mean, one, there's the great Henry Rollins expression in Get in the Van, where he says you're never truly an American until you left. And so I'm sure there were sort of maybe perspectives on U.S. culture when you were in Ireland, but I'm sure also being that kind of, that being that perpetual outsider with maybe intimate knowledge also gives you, or gave you, some interesting insights in Irish culture, right?
I think so. I mean, I was definitely, I guess you could say, critiquing Irish culture, Irishness, Irish identity, what it means to be Irish. I think in a lot of the poems in ancestor worship, it's kind of what that collection is about, I guess. So I was absorbed by Irish culture and intensely interested in it. Like I said, I learned the Irish language fluently, and extremely interested in it. But, you know, as an outsider, especially as an American, a Yank, you know, I doubt that Irish culture ever fully accepted me in the same way as a quote-unquote, you know, real Irish person would be.
Yeah, which I think is also, too, I mean, I think one of the things about our culture, the U.S. culture, is because we are, am I going to really quote Field of Dreams? I think I am. You know, the blackboard that's been written on, erased, and written over, you know, we're recording this in a 100-year-old house, or a house that will be 100 this fall, which is ancient by most American cities and most U.S. cities, newer ones. I mean, they look like they were all bought at Big Lots or something. Like there was a kit.
Yeah.
It all looks fake and weird and
indisposable. No.
Whereas you have this sort of, I guess you could say, this ingrained culture. It was also a culture that, for the sake of its own sovereignty, was sort of fought for.
Right.
You know.
Absolutely.
So even, you know, even notions of, like, I guess, patriotism and nationalism are very different for them than it is for us, which...
Yeah. You know. I mean, for the most part, Irish nationalism, I would say, is progressive, anti-colonial. Mm-hmm. Whereas when we think of, you know, American nationalism, it's pretty colonial. Pretty imperialistic, oftentimes. And can be associated with certain kinds of people.
Yeah, I mean, is there an Irish equivalent to Toby Keith?
Country music is very big in Ireland, but not in the Toby Keith way.
Ah.
I mean, you know who they really like in Ireland is Garth Brooks.
Really?
Yeah. They also have their own country musicians, Daniel O'Donnell, but Garth Brooks is huge in Ireland.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, is that for something for you, like, I tried to escape this, like...
Yeah, you know? Kind of. I'm sure I thought of that at times. I've never been into New Country, or what they used to call
Bro
New Country.
Bro Country.
Now it's just...
Yeah. I like Bro Country.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. That's a good one. Pop Country, I don't know. That stuff is all terrible, obviously. Just like any, you know, just like anywhere, even in Ireland, there are people with bad taste in music, bad taste in culture.
Yeah, kitsch. I mean, right? Yeah. I mean, there is kitsch. Kitsch is universal. It's
kitsch can have a positive sense, but, you know, it can also just be empty and hollow and cheesy.
Yeah,
and people,
terrible. And
there are people with
and
empty, hollow musical tastes throughout the world.
That's, yeah, you see, again, that's perspective, because I think you know, if you read enough comments on, like, the Huffington Post, though you're never supposed to read the comments, I mean, there is that sort of fetishization of Europe, and, oh, they're just so much more sophisticated than us.
I mean, you know, you watch French films, and you think that everyone is a deep thinker in Europe, you know, and not always the case.
Yeah, I mean, were you, like, was there anything you found over there that also, like, kind of bled in, like, our culture that sort of colonialized, you know? Because, I mean, that's the thing.
American media dominates Ireland, and British media to an extent, too, but it's American films, often American TV shows, you know, and there's Irish films and Irish TV shows and Irish, you know, country musicians or what have you. But, you know, the American blockbuster Hollywood films and that stuff is a staple in Ireland, just as much as it is here.
Yeah. And of course, though, I mean, they do have, like, I guess, public support for the arts because of that, right? To institutionalize, yeah. They know we need to hold back and support mm-hmm. our filmmakers, our musicians, our...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we have the National Endowment for the Arts here in the U.S., but that's probably not, proportionally not as heavily financed as I think the Arts Council in Ireland probably is to an extent. Of course, with recent economic problems, arts funding in Ireland is getting cut. I mean, the arts always suffer first when the cuts come. But yeah, no, there's the Arts Council in Ireland is supported by the government, puts a lot of money into you know, various Irish artistic endeavors.
Cool. Yeah. So, and also then too, you know, to flip around, I mean, I think were there also places where, or times where you were just sort of so aware of your own Americanness?
Well, they wouldn't really usually let me forget it.
Oh, really?
Right. No, you're, especially if you're American, again, Ireland has kind of, I would say, a love-hate relationship with America.
Mm-hmm. Sid Vicious, Nancy Spungent, sort of.
Kind of, yeah. You know, and there, in some ways, there are so many commonalities. So many Irish have come to America. Mm-hmm. So many Irish people have been to America and come back. There's just that inherent, you could say, almost family connection of, you know, the Irish having been in America, been such a strong presence in America. It's been one of, you know, probably the major emigration destination. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, with the language, the common language, i.e. being English in this case, American media can very easily infiltrate,
translate.
And so Irish culture is very, or American culture is very familiar to the Irish.
Yeah. But of course, that doesn't go two ways, because, I mean, the awfulness of St. Patrick's Day, I think, you know, is our concept is...
Well, it's taking root over there now.
Oh, no, potatoes. It's all just potatoes.
Bigger and, well, they have bigger and messier parades, and, that style of St. Patrick's Day has started to take hold there. But yeah, and I think because America dominates in the media to such a large extent, and, you know, politically throughout the world, there's also kind of a little bit of resentment in Ireland about America, mm-hmm. and so being an American in Ireland is a weird sort of state to be in. And the worst thing you can do is be Irish-American and go to Ireland and say, I'm Irish. You're like, what? No, you're American. What are you talking about?
I mean, yeah, so again, I think that there is, so, I mean, there it is also then, there's maybe a sense of maybe a sort of a genuine culture versus, I mean, use like the Baudrillard term, like the simulacra kind of thing too, you know?
Yeah, that could be it, you know. Ireland obviously has a really an ancient culture going back a couple thousand years that's been put under pressure at various points in history, but still exists. And I imagine most European countries have that sense of their much longer history, and that gives them a different perspective than Americans have.
Absolutely. So I guess then too is then were there though culture shocks coming back to the States, you know, in terms of, oh yeah, this was sort of nicer or different, or, you know.
Yeah, sure. Well, unfortunately, you know, no matter where you live, there's always going to be something that you miss. When I lived in Ireland, I missed baseball games. That was the main thing. Looking back, you know, it was baseball games. Once in a blue moon, there used to be an NBC station that was broadcast worldwide that would, like, once a week show a game. And then, I don't know what happened. They went out of business, or I no longer had them on my cable system or something. So I missed baseball. Coming back, it's been the Irish language that I miss the most. But But you're really asking reacclimating to American culture. Right. I think it led me to kind of a period of my own sort of shallow cultural taste, because, like I said earlier, being out of touch with America, when I would see things like Survivor or Jackass or like silly reality shows, that's what would remind me of American culture the most. And so I think when I came back, I went on a binge of just watching those kind of shows for a while, a lot. And that's kind of what reacclimated me to American culture, was TV.
And I mean, to your defense or whatever, I mean, Jackass is brilliant.
Well, that
I mean,
actually
Bam Margera good... might be the finest human that we have produced as a nation, don't you think? or is it Steve-O? Actually, it would probably be Steve-O.
I'm probably just going to lean more towards Johnny Knoxville in terms of like the Jackass crew.
Yeah.
But no, they all had their moments. That's a solid choice. There was, I have to say, like out of a lot of those kinds of shows, I'll stand by Jackass to an extent, and they do a lot of really funny things.
Well, I think they do a lot of really funny things, and I think, you know, I was teaching this summer Ryan Dunn died.
That
hit people really hard. And I think it's not just what they did, but the sense of community.
Yeah.
You know, which I'll say when I was into that show, I was, you know, sort of fresh out of college, which in itself is this experiment in communal living.
Yeah.
And I had this really shitty, boring job that, you know, just slowly killed me, and I was the only person there, I think, under the age of 45, who wasn't a housewife, who... I mean, they were good people, they were cool people, they were nice people, but in terms of common interests and common worldview, I was very much alone, and so that show would come on every Sunday night, and I could face Monday, because, you know, like, I virtually experienced that community or whatever,
and
watch people get hurt, you know, I mean, that's
right,
you know, it's, which is different than YouTube, because YouTube's full of that, and that's fun too, but
yeah, I haven't really, I mean, I'm sure there's some, you know, good YouTube channels out there that are doing similar things, but I haven't found them,
but yeah, they're not, yeah, it's not the same kind of sense. It's just, you know, people riding bikes in the signs. There's these guys down south that's what they do. They go to the road signs, they're the big metal ones with the dual posts, and they'll ride a bike and hit the sign face first and fall off. And that's
there's only so much you can do. I mean, I think kind of with Jackass, they kind of explored that milieu to the extent possible, and people kind of trying to repeat it. It's just now it's just kind of played out.
But, yeah.
It's a very, in terms of the camaraderie, yeah, I agree. It's a very male kind of thing, though, I think.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, right, but...
Which, I guess that's the other thing, too, is, I mean, I think a lot of males go through that stage.
Yeah.
They just found a way to get paid for it, you know?
Right.
I gave it away for free, you know? I certainly can't take headshots like I used to.
Yeah, well, what are you now, 40?
Are we not
revealing that? On
No, 37. But I think 37, yeah, right. Almost 38. Yeah. But right. I think, and I think my doctor will agree with you. I am at the end of my useful life. I think, as far as my contribution to society,
well, or at least ability to, you know, far
function as a human being.
Yeah. Well, maybe doing pranks, but you know, hopefully you'll have many more rich years as a university instructor ahead of you.
I doubt it. I think it's over. I think it's, you know.
Well, right. Well, at least you don't have to go up for tenure now that this is going to be made public.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. No, that ship's already sailed on other episodes. So I guess the next thing, you know, Jackass aside, is like sort of what you've carried with you in all of these different experiences in terms of, you know, your own kind of consistency as you know, because I'm sure, you know, the life of a hardcore drummer is probably less comfortable. Actually, no. Did it pay more than university professor? Or
there was never any pay in that.
There's no pay in that.
I mean, I think like we got paid for shows a little bit later as like you know, in Heart of Darkness. Although Waste of Talent did play a few bar sets in State College, and so we must have gotten something for that. Something, but that was that. So long ago.
I say though, I mean, you know, Belial. So and Waste of Talent too. I mean, it was mentioned in the American Hardcore book and documentary.
Yeah.
And there is going to be a reissue of the Wasted Talent.
Almost all of our songs are about to come out on record.
Wow.
Right. So, well, all right. I'll keep you. Let's keep your wider question in mind. Like, how do you sort of negotiate the sense of having, you know, done so many different things and but so Wasted Talent. Our claim to fame, which is extremely minimal, is that we were on a compilation album in 1983 called The Master Tape Volume 2, which was on Affirmation Records, which was put out by Paul Ahern from the Zero Boys, and he put out two of those. That was Volume 2. It was a known hardcore compilation that came out at the time. And then when Stephen Blush did his American Hardcore History book, that record is there listed in the discography at the back of the book, and we're mentioned somewhere. I think there's some short section on, you know, Central Pennsylvania or something. We're mentioned there. One of my brother's flyers for the band is also reproduced in the book. And strangely, this was strange to me at first, I couldn't believe it, was that our band symbol is on the flyleaf of that book. If you remember it, there's the flyleaf of all these different hardcore band symbols, because that was kind of one of the things. Like, a lot of hardcore bands had a symbol of some sort. Like, there's the Black Flag bars.
Yes.
I don't know, Social Distortion had that, like, sort of minimalist cartoon of a guy with the fedora before fedoras became hipster trendy, like, decades later.
Yeah.
And so there's all these hardcore band logos, and I picked up that book and I saw the Waste of Talent symbol, and I was like, how the hell did that get there? I mean, we were so, you know, so not a major band.
Which, you know, but for hardcore, it's sort of like there was the Pittsburgh band Car Sickness.
I think
Spin did a thing, top 100 obscure American bands, and they were number 99.
Huh.
And Carl Mullen, who was in that band, said in the Post Gazette, was like, "Yeah, that's like actually on that list, that's like being number two,
right?
You know, don't you want to be?"
Yeah.
But I mean, that was though. I mean, I'm sure that was also a very exciting era, though. I mean, that was one of the last,
definitely,
or one of the great kind of periods in, you know, I think, American culture and American music.
I think so. I mean, I think since then, since the hardcore era, the mainstream media finally figured out how to co-opt underground movements and not oppose them.
Yeah.
And so I think hardcore was, so far anyway, we'll see what happens in the future, but it, as far as I can tell, correct me if I'm wrong, there might have been some continuing offshoots of the hardcore scene for a while that did this, but I think it's really the last underground youth movement that was really, so to speak, off the grid and was just not part of mainstream culture at all, was not commercialized really at all. It was almost all completely independent labels, completely independent fanzines, people booking tours themselves by calling people on stolen phone cards throughout the country. People setting up shows in an abandoned warehouse or whatever, and just completely do-it-yourself scene that did not depend on any kind of affirmation from mainstream society.
Yeah,
I don't think we've quite seen it since then.
I think you're right. And you think, I mean, I think there's a sort of a noise thing happening out there, but, you know,
I'm sure in isolated in places there are groups of people who are still doing that.
Yeah.
But as a mass, nationwide, worldwide movement, that probably not in the same way.
Yeah, and you think, I mean, it's fascinating too. And again, thinking about your journey or your reincarnations, you know, you had one cultural movement you identified with that you know, was very new, very... I mean, they kind of had also that sort of avant-garde spirit. You know, there were things that were being rejected. I mean, I showed some students of... Actually, ours, I think, that you had some of them, too, the American Hardcore documentary. And they
Our Waste of Talent's bass players in the, the movie, too.
Yeah, and I, at the time, I didn't know. I probably wouldn't have said anything anyway, because that would have been awkward.
What would you really say?
Yeah, I didn't know somebody who knows that person, really. He works here. but the students were the idea that you could have a creative movement about rejecting things, you know. Students didn't understand the difference between hardcore and metal. There was a lot of rhetoric about like how stupid metal was, and there was a scene with a guy, one of the guys from Bad Brains was like, yeah, we were in this place and there were these metal guys and they were flexing and it was really weird. It was freaking me out, man. And people didn't understand, you know, this, that we could do something, we could reject things, certain things weren't okay, and we can make something wholly new. And then there's, you know, with learning Gaelic, you know, getting in touch with reclaiming a culture that far precedes, you know, that century, this century, you know, your human experience, something that was so new, and then also finding worth or interest in something that is so old or so, you know, so reclaiming a tradition, trying to keep it alive.
Kind of, it's fascinating in a way. So doing that is, you're right, it kind of is in some sense like the opposite of being in the hardcore scene and it being of the moment and creating just something new with that sort of youthful energy in that moment, in that cultural moment in time. And then so I mean I guess I've gone through many stages in my life. And you know, my interests have evolved over time. I guess that the way I look at it is that, well, really, to be alive in the world, you do have to evolve. And if you just stay the same all the time, then that's kind of boring. And, you know, my favorite artists are oftentimes ones who do radically change their sound or their style. You know, one reason why I really like Amiri Baraka, for example, as a poet, is he's one of those people who has gone through some radically different phases in his creative career, you know, and just changed almost sometimes seemingly overnight in terms of his political interests, his stylistic interests, his motivations. So that's interesting to me. You know, even you look at the first three Stooges albums, and I've got Stooges poems, as you know. The first three real studio albums, they're all radically different from each other. They radically evolved from album to album. And, you know, why rehash the same old shit over and over again? So I guess that's kind of the way I've lived my life to an extent. At least in terms of, like, you know, artistic stuff. You know, I don't think that I'm so shallow that there isn't some kind of core me that comes along through each phase. But, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of hardcore nostalgia now, but, I mean...
You're not interested.
I'm certainly... I mean, I'm interested to an extent, but it's just nostalgia, and I recognize the limitations of that. But so, you know, and we're releasing... Or this, you know, label's releasing the Waste of Talent stuff, and that's kind of weird and interesting to go back to that. But it's like, I'm glad I'm not one of those people who stayed punk the whole time, and that was all I ever did. And, you know, and... it's interesting to come back to it now, having done other things, but...
Well, and I think, too, it gets also to the core of... I think one of the interesting things about... One of the many interesting things about your poetry is that there are also these juxtapositions where there's a role of media, like you have Stooges poems, you have poems, you know, Betty Page, about these sort of, like... manufactured, a hard way to describe it, but manufactured sort of human-made phenomena. Mm-hmm. And then you also have poems that are also great about, you know, whether it's being in nature or, you know, looking at a hotel window or something, where it's just this sort of organic kind of life stuff, and that you can, you know, focus and kind of have a consistent poetic voice and focus on these sort of very sort of unnatural things, as well as these sort of and very natural things, and these things that are sort of larger than any of us in terms of, you know, media and life, but, you know, and also do translations of nationalist poems from the year 1800, you know, in, right. in ancestor worship, you know. I find that sort of fascinating, is the sort of the look at those things kind of equally or with an equal eye.
Yeah, well, I guess even I don't think of myself as overtly trying to do this, but I guess what you're describing is kind of just the basic situation of the postmodern age.
Mm.
You know, isn't that what postmodernism is? Oh, and one level yeah. is partly about is the high and the low,
mm-hmm.
popular culture mixed right, in yeah. with I don't know what is the opposite of popular culture. I don't know.
Anyway, I mean, well, that's interesting because you think about it. I mean, there is that. I think that attempt at sort of indie culture, or there's yeah. people who sort of actively resist, but then it just gets co-opted. I mean, we went to a movie last night at Southside Works, and oh look, our Urban Art Filters has vinyl, and I think they are the number one retailer of vinyl in the country.
What is?
Urban Outfitters.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's been going around. But I was just looking at this place, you know, stores that clothes that I would never buy and things I just think are just horrible pop culture things. And then suddenly you look and there's, you know, a Joy Division record.
Yeah.
You yeah. know, which is sort of like...
I think, wasn't it Urban Outfitters that Minor Threat actually licensed their t-shirt design to? Couple years ago,
yeah,
kind of
which
a
is
minor controversy in mm-hmm. whatever passes for the punk scene these days.
Yeah,
some people were, you know, up in arms that yeah. Minor Threat actually licensed the yeah. Out of Step design to Urban Outfitters.
Yeah,
I don't know. Sounds yeah, like yeah. Well, I mean, if you're alive in the world and you're a poet or an artist, as I try to be, mm-hmm. then you're going to be responding to all different aspects things. Of life, I think.
You're right. I mean, Douglas Copeland has a thing saying about how that we, you know, how could we even imagine or creatively imagine sort of a non-media...
Yeah.
Well, it would be art form or consciousness,
yeah.
which means then is the next step sort of poetry about websites.
I mean, it's already happening.
Oh, no, is it really?
Yeah, I mean, there's...
See, I'm just saying it's a good thing, and then suddenly this gut kind of cultural conservative right. reaction inside. Yeah. Like, no, not Huffington Post.
Yeah.
Huffington Post is on website.
Right, I know what you mean. I mean, there's yeah. something kind of silly and ooky about, you know, poems about the internet. And I mean, what is a good way to write about the internet? Probably something that actually gets into its form and the way that it mediates experience, rather than just throwing in a bunch of like internet terms into your like, you know, lyric poetry. It would probably be the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, or just put, you know, write a regular poem and then just put .com after the title.
Yeah, right,
you know?
There you go.
You know, and then hope that domain's not registered or, you know.
Yeah.
Spend the day fishing around GoDaddy or whatever. Damn it, that's already been written.
Yeah.
You know, can't
yeah.
write that one.
Yeah. What else?
Well, actually, I do want to get to the bottom five in a minute, but actually, could we, you know, since for folks who might want to say purchase, you know, but
oh,
could
yeah.
we hear some poems? Could we?
Yeah.
And actually,
sure.
could I be a complete monster and not only request, I guess, maybe poem, could you read one of the Gaelic poems?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to understand it, but and maybe somebody will, but I would, but or whatever you want to do, you know, is you're the one
yeah,
hawking books
that.
Here.
I can do that. maybe I, yeah, it's been a while since I've read these. I hope my accent isn't too horrendous. But
well, it'll probably just sound like a Yank.
I will sound like a Yank or Plunkanach, as which is the word for Yank in Irish.
Which is not the word you want to hear. Like, say you're at the pub.
Yeah, you know.
You don't want to.
On fucking Plunkanach shin. Yeah. All right. Well, this is a poem that sort of deals with that issue of, well, I guess actually this one is called Mar Verdachanach, and it gets into the Irish coming to America, and sort of the effect that, I don't know, that kind of, that I guess that maybe that the famine has that sort of looms in the background of the Irish immigrant experience. It's called Mar Verdachanach, and it begins with an epigraph from Páirg O'Hegarty, who wrote a poem called Ochon Aghanacha, and it goes Garav Delav Lum An Yelga Askalcha Es Ok An Korha E. My poem goes Mar Escapa Mar Riav Via Mar Escapa Trasna na Bokna Glasha Devar Okrush Aduru Antamshin No Mar Yao Ar Hora An Okrush Mas Vajur Ra Godana Grudikinch As Anrud Ar As Krana Riav As Kak Agashin Gortaha Hurling Ar Vruak Ashik Konkrecha Mar Indi Rukasacha Agvilla On Mas Travach ag Iri on Sala Ganach Kupla Fokal Berla Sawada Lig Agus Jagri Amar Sinn Fein Emaskna Gil Sorajana Namlakana Mara Jagri Ariev Ag Lorag Ebra Agus Vrushi Rabian Stak Snashanamori Aglisha via Kalarect Aginya Abolition Snapilir a Fall Kraken Jerag Nanuchisuk Arnamana Sn smachtini pace a chnag cligna gormo am gochela. Slav yon a grammy glinya a gunya dorcha anvar. Y gul ti a tevru ar rahana nias fjar.
All right.
Yeah. Maybe someone will get that one.
Someone will get that. So maybe you can avail us one or two in English, too, maybe?
Yeah, right. Well, we talked, yes, before we started, we talked about maybe reading the poem Waterworld. Yeah. Both of these are, by the way, in my collection Future Blues, which is my newest one. It came out from Salmon Poetry, an Irish publisher, an international publisher based in Ireland, mostly Irish and American poets. And anyway, it's called Future Blues, and one of the poems in there is called Waterworld, and the last line is what Matt wanted to title this episode of the show. This, too, despite my contemporary or popular cultural interests, gets back into aspects of history and more ancient cultures, but hopefully, well, you all can be the judge, but hopefully done in a contemporarily engaging way.
Yes.
Okay, it's called Waterworld. Glug, 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 the rainwater off the outside of the building, still voices talking below the open window. Today, a film of blue sky remained behind the swirling, dark, smoky clouds, which suddenly opened up. Bullets fell in multiple volleys on roof slates. The cats scurried to their dens in disgust. With a preponderance of daylight reemerging, I took to the asphalt. At the bridge, I was engulfed. Wedged into a right angle of a rough stone smithy wall, a corrugated metal sheet, a tangled branchy mass of ivy hanging overhead, I wondered what would happen if I chewed the leaves. Stood and imagined the Belgic invasion, how they came ashore in boats, waded among the reeds, the marshes, the rushes, marched along the Esker, built avenues into Turo, and established their seat. Each death finds me in a new location, a gigantic puddle in the middle of Shop Street. Soon the winter will come. Reincarnation back on the agenda. Yeah, and right, and I see why you wanted to go with that end of that one for the show, because I guess that's kind of what I was thinking there at the very end, you know, sort of having these little moments where you realize that you are in a completely different place than you were the last time, or that you'll be in a different place again. I guess change, you know, change is the only constant thing. Heraclitus.
Yeah.
You know, the thing about you can't step into the same river twice.
Yeah, yeah. Or I like the George Santana's Cloud Castles, you know, about, you know, there's that great opening line about how, you know, philosophers don't fault the fish for their propensity to live underwater, but many people, you know, fault life for its propensity to change.
Yeah, I've only read
exactly what that is, you know, life.
Right.
Is.
Only read Santayana sparingly, but
me too.
I affirm you on that in that reference.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, and now it's time for the bottom five.
Okay.
Speaking of change, let's radically change the format of the show.
That's the way. That's
all right, it's bottom five. It's a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical, me speak the good English, nature. Are you ready?
I'll do my best.
All right, question one. If reincarnation is real, and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease would you choose to be? if you totally fucked up, you know, in life, and so you had to start over again at the sort of single cell level, and that's something right. that would, you know, make people ill.
That's tough, because you don't really want to, you know, you don't want to be a negative influence on people. You don't want to, right, make people ill, but I guess, right, if that's the premise of the question, then it would have to be some kind of venereal disease, because at least people are, you know, having a good time as they get it.
Yeah?
I don't know, what's the most manageable one?
Oh, that's a good point.
You know, syphilis. It's syphilis, curable.
Yeah.
It's completely now it's curable.
Post 1950 syphilis, basically, is where it's at.
Yeah, nowadays it's really pretty innocuous, because, you know, you can just go and get a shot or some antibiotic. So I'll go with syphilis.
Yeah, so penicillin, all right, takes care of you in the next life. Yeah. Question two. If you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night?
Wow.
Which, actually, now think about it. So let's think about this now. So say the Earth stops spinning, and somehow magically gravity and all that other stuff still works.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow our climate is not, it doesn't become the moon where one's like 500 degrees and a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And say one of the continents you lived on is day and one of them is night. Which one would you be hoping for? You know?
Yeah.
Would you like go, can you go back to Ireland? It's night, or they have sunshine there. Or what? How would that work? So if you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night?
Day or night. That's tough, because I personally tend to be more of a night person. And, you know, I'm more creative at night usually, and I sometimes feel like I think better at night. On the other hand, I think if there literally was no day at all and it was constant night, everyone would be, like, suffering from seasonal affective disorder, basically, or some form of that constantly. And I think it would be pretty disastrous for people. More broadly, so if you're asking me, if the question really means, are you more of a day or a night person? Personally, I'm more of a night person, but the way the question is phrased, I'm going to have to say, for the good of everyone, probably we should keep the day, and so I'd have to go with the elimination of night, I guess.
Yeah, which, I mean, and also the whole growing food thing.
Yeah, need that.
You do need that,
need food.
All right. Question three. I've actually had a last-minute change.
Okay.
In the bottom five, I had a question picked out. I'm skipping it. The new question three is, what is the strangest injury you have ever suffered? Not the worst injury, but like the weirdest injury, meaning
like injury, like, yeah, like where there's not like illness, but injury where there's an event.
An that event, sort to of. You. I think who's it? Who was it on the Braves in the 90s? I think Steve Avery like ironed a shirt he was wearing and then burned his chest.
Okay, yeah,
he tried that. So I mean, the strangest thing that's ever ever caused you bodily harm.
I can't think of a whole lot. I've been pretty lucky. Mm. Knock on wood.
Actually, that's particle board. It's okay. IKEA.
That's what. Knock on wood. I've been pretty lucky about that so far. And the injuries that I've had, I broke my toe once.
Not under interesting circumstances.
Not really. Just on the on the corner of a couch, walking by barefoot.
Oh.
But you know, it did. The toe was sticking out at a really awkward angle, almost perpendicular to the others.
Oh.
And you know, what can they really do for a broken toe? They just tape it to the next one. But that's about all I got, unless okay. Maybe someone could remind me of something, but I can't.
You'll get an email.
I can't think of any other injuries.
All right. Question four. You're almost out of the woods. Now we're over the hump. Question four. Or it's actually not even a question. It's a prompt.
Okay.
Tell me a happy...
You want me to write an essay?
No, yes. Yes. Tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood.
But unremarkable.
So it can't be like, we went to Disney World. No, but like, we made cookies that one day it rained or something.
Okay, well, this is one that nobody actually... I've told this to people who know me closely. I've probably told this to, but I'll now tell it on an internet podcast. And nobody ever believes it's true, because nobody believes that you can possibly have conscious memories from when you were, like, 1 year old. But I do, and there's a memory of being 1 year old that I have at the beach at Puget Sound in Washington State, where my parents lived when I was born. And at some point, I cut my foot on glass on the water, so I'm told. But that's not the memory. Mm. The memory is maybe a week or two later and being at the beach again, but having to wear sneakers in the water and having the sensation of the squishiness of the sneakers and finding it really unpleasant. And knowing at the same time that I was somehow forced into this by some greater force than me, i.e. my parents, but not really understanding why or what was going on, but just the physical sensation of the squishiness that I had to deal with.
Wow. You know, I have memories of standing up in my crib, so I'm with you, I believe. And I have memories of standing in my crib, and I swear I remember a TV saying it was the 1 year anniversary of Elvis's death.
Really?
Yes.
So that would have been 78.
Yeah, and I was born in 77, so so I'm with you in terms of the, there's no way you can, which then I guess would be my first memory. And I always told people my first memory was walking into the backyard and seeing that raccoons had gotten into our garbage. And it was back when the Kraft Deluxe macaroni and cheese, it was a can, not a pouch. And I remember seeing the can and thinking that I like that. I like that. I want some of that right now.
Interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. So both know that it is possible to have consciousness and memories that last from almost from the beginning.
Yes. We have proven it scientifically on this podcast.
That's right.
Right now.
Right. So psychologists and so on will want to
kind of re-edit
this and use it in their studies.
And cite it, yes. All right. So question five, the last one, it's almost over. And this, I think, will appeal to you as a writer and scholar.
Okay.
Of the living, villains of history, living, this person has to be alive right now. This is the Christopher Hitchens question. Of the living villains of history, whose obituary would you most like to write?
Mm.
if you were back, say, in journalism or whatever, or writing for a journal, living villain of history that you say, okay, I want to write this person's obituary.
I did do some journalism for an Irish language newspaper, come to think of it. I don't. Who are the living villains? I mean, the obvious, and you know, since you mentioned Christopher Hitchens, you know, you'd have to think of like W. Bush comes to mind as one of the biggest, I suppose. He doesn't really appeal to me in terms of someone that I
like. That's not a compelling story,
right? Yeah. Exactly. He's not a figure that I could really get interested in terms of writing about him. I don't know. I'm drawing a blank. You know, he's the obvious, but
those sort of tragic figures of, you know, because I mean, for Hitchens, he said, you know, it was in his book Forever. It's a book about mortality, the last one.
That's right. Yeah.
And he said that was one of his first thoughts when he got his fatal diagnosis. I was really looking forward to reading the obituaries of Cardinal Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, and Henry Kissinger. And then he's like, wait a minute, I wanted to write those. So
there's a lot more you could probably do with Kissinger even than Bush in terms of making an essay compelling.
Yeah.
But you're feeding me choices because I'm drawing a blank. I don't have a favorite contemporary villain that
Torvald
fascinates me.
Or Fred Wilpon. How about Fred Wilpon?
Okay, right. Baseball. Torberg was a former...
He was the manager of the worst team that money could buy.
But he was, also a bad manager.
He was. He was...
So I was saying earlier, when I lived in Ireland, one of the things that I missed was baseball. And Matt and I are both New York Mets fans.
Which, is that really liking baseball? I know, except for this year.
Well, they're doing better this year. But Fred Wilpon, as owner, has... done some terrible things, and you know, he's not. He didn't have the power to start unnecessary wars in the Middle East like George W. Bush.
Yeah.
But he's part of that contemporary thing where, you know, he's part of the 1%. Like a hedge fund guy or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And got involved with Ponzi schemes. Apparently, I guess I should say allegedly.
Allegedly.
Actually, he agreed to a settlement.
He did agree to a settlement.
He did pay a settlement with the person who is recouping victims of Bernie Madoff. So,
which I believe one of those victims was Kevin Bacon.
Really?
Yeah.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. So actually, so some of Fred Wilpon's money... He's going to Kevin Bacon, I believe.
Okay.
Or in some way, you know, I'm sure you can't trace the actual individual dollars. But
so whether or not he actually admitted guilt, he did agree to a settlement, which implies some kind of guilt. Responsibility involvement.
Yeah. I think, and it was actually one of those, like, sort of George W. administration defenses where it was like, we weren't evil, we were just really dumb.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, I think Wilpon's attempt at a defense is my good friend Bernie Madoff deceived me, just like he did everyone else.
Yes.
But, you know, he's put his business dealings ahead of the team and has cynically tried to hold on to the team while, trying to get out from under this economic situation he created for himself. And the team has suffered now for years.
Yes.
But they're coming back a little bit, it seems, so who knows?
Yeah, I think it's so damn it. I mean, they're 6 games over .500 right now, and I'm like, they're the worst 6 games over .500 team in baseball.
I know. It's shocking that they're still over .500, and last I checked, like a game and a half out. I don't know what the
You know what? They're going to be able to feast on the Phillies this year. I mean, that's going to be the thing that's going to keep them hanging on, is there is a team in their division that they play a bunch of times that is... so wondrously awful, actually.
Yeah.
It's the way it ought to be. The Phillies, I think it's the world is more in balance when the Phillies are bad, so.
Yeah. Yeah. So. But it's a good rivalry when New York and Philadelphia are both good.
I don't want rivalry. I want domination.
Yeah, well, no. Given the choice, that I do too.
Yes. All right, and on that happy note, I think that's about it. So we will have on the website the Salmon Poetry Bookstore link or whatever, if you want the great collections, Future Blues and Ancestor Worship. So in the Waste of Talent
record is going to come out this year, probably in a couple of months. It's going to be on a label called Going Underground Records, which is based in Bakersfield, California, of all places.
I'll try to find a link to at least their page, and then, you know, this lives on in perpetuity forever.
It's not up there yet, but it should be out soon.
Yes. All right. So our next episode, speaking of things that'll be out soon, our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our web homepage where you can find new and old episodes is GunnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GunnaDiePodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook, and I think there's a Google Plus page too, though apparently Google Plus isn't going to exist much longer.
Oh, really?
And I'm the only person who likes the page. I think there's one other person. There's two people who like the page, and I haven't updated it for over a year, but you can find us there. Thanks to Brett Zork, as always, for the lovely theme music. Thank you, Mike, for coming and taking time out of your day to do this.
Thank you for having me. I'm flattered that you were interested enough to ask me questions about
art. They're good poems. Later, meats.